Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the other face of Facebook and look into how the co-founder of the social network is avoiding $600 million in taxes. Elise Hoag, former senior advisor to Media Matters and director of political advocacy and communication at MoveOn.org, joins us to discuss this and how the 99% can level the electoral playing field as the 1% pour in millions to buy the 2012 elections. Then we'll look into increasing political tensions in Spain, where youth unemployment is over 50% and mass demonstrations are expected to culminate tomorrow on the one-year anniversary of the founding of the Indignants movement. Anthony Geist, a professor at the University of Washington who specializes in contemporary literature and culture of Spain, joins us to discuss the political mood in a country that might soon join Greece as the next insolvent country in the Eurozone. Then finally, we'll discuss the economic and political tensions in Spain further with Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, a professor of Spanish studies at the University of Illinois Urbana. We will look into the Spanish national identity that has not been reconciled following the murderous reign of the Franco dictatorship and the role of the disgraced king and the current conservative government who are imposing austerity while denying historical memory. And joining us now is Elise Hoag, who is a social change practitioner, media consumer and analyst, and online engagement expert. Previously, she served as senior advisor to Media Matters for America, director of political advocacy and communications for MoveOn.org, and program director at the Rainforest Action Network. She was the recipient of the Business Ethics Network Award in 2005 for her work in the financial sector and has been a frequent speaker and writer about corporate power, corporate accountability, and multinational institutions that govern and financial and corporate behavior. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elise Hoag.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And you have an article at Agence Global that caught my attention, Lessons in Disloyalty, Eduardo Saverin and the Facebook IPO. Eduardo Saverin, of course, is the co-founder of Facebook. He was featured in the movie The Social Network as something of a victim that his friend, his Harvard roommate, Zuckerberg, had sort of aced him out of Facebook, but he nevertheless ended up with 4% of the shares. And to save $600 million in taxes, he's giving up his U.S. citizenship after having been essentially welcomed to the United States as a political refugee from Brazil. Not exactly gratitude.
Well, right, especially as you mentioned, since his family moved here when he was 13 from Brazil because he was under the threat of being kidnapped since his father was a wealthy businessman. So the U.S. took him in and provided him a home. He became a citizen in 1998. He attended schools, even including Harvard, that get a generous amount of taxpayer dollars to make them that the excellent institutions that they are. And then, as you said, you know, it's a little cut and run for Mr. Saverin ahead of the IPO that stands to make him billions of dollars.
So he'd already set up shop in Singapore, right? That's where he's moving to.
Yes, he's in Singapore. He apparently has been back and forth. And, you know, we don't know the details because they're private. We do know that his lawyers claim he actually renounced his citizenship some months ago, but the IRS reported it last week. And, you know, as you say, the timing is a bit suspicious. The interesting way that our tax laws work is he will actually have to pay, quote, an exit tax in order to renounce his citizenship, but the exit tax is valued by his own team of accountants and lawyers, what they think he's worth at the time he renounced his citizenship. And so the timing is a bit suspect, since regardless of when he announces it, as long as it's before the IPO, he will be worth much less than he will be when the price is publicly fixed in the billions and billions of dollars.
So in the movie The Social Network, as I mentioned, he was portrayed as something of a victim of Zuckerberg, having been his roommate. He put up the seed money for Facebook and then got aced out of the investment. What's your understanding of their relationship today, if any?
Yeah, I don't have any personal insight into that. I mean, I think it's, you know, one of the things that we need to watch is how Mark Zuckerberg has said himself he will be paying the $1 billion. He's asked the board to slash his salary next year to a single dollar. And so there's a really different personification of the wealthy one percenters, this new generation that risks feeling as though they are not bound to any country like sovereign versus Zuckerberg, who's been an epitome of giving back. But the one thing I do want to make sure your listeners get is, you know, and this was one of the reasons that I was moved to write the article, is that there are so many millions of people who really aspire to be part of the United States with all of the giving back that that requires. They only want to pay their taxes. Even undocumented workers in this country pay their taxes. So when someone of the wealth and privilege of sovereign comes along and actually uses the resources of our country and then skates off and doesn't give back, it could really do a disservice to help people understand the spirit of giving and entrepreneurship that really is embodied by most immigrants who aspire to be American.
And in your article, Elise Hoag, Lessons in Disloyalty, Eduardo Saverin and the Facebook IPO, you point out that according to the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy, undocumented immigrants in the United States paid over $11.2 billion in taxes in 2010.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, I think people don't realize that anytime there's a paycheck, they get taxes out, but more and more, there's sales tax, right? And there's not a single person in the United States that does not pay a sales tax. So often you get the middle class and working class immigrants who are actually doing what they are expected to do to become American citizens. And then you've got the one percenters who seem to be the same all over the world, really.
So, Elise Hoag, the 4% share that Saverin has in Facebook, in terms of the IPO, the upcoming IPO, that he skipped town in order not to pay $600 million in taxes, he must be getting one hell of a payday.
Well, the $600 million figure is projected actually by another writer in Pando Daily, but it seems to match up with a lot of the estimates on what he would be giving back to the Treasury on future capital gains income from the sales of those Facebook shares later on. So that's over the course of his lifetime. But yeah, his 4% share, which as I mentioned in the article, was awarded to him by a judge because certainly we saw in the movie Zuckerberg and Sean Parker wanted to edge him out of the deal. His 4% share is projected to be worth somewhere between $3 and $4 billion after Thursday when the IPO goes public.
So you're saying that Zuckerberg, by comparison, is virtuous. That's certainly not what the film shows.
I'm not positive I would go that far, mostly because I just don't know the guy. But what we have seen is that he's not in any way protesting, that he will probably have the largest tax bill that anyone has ever experienced in this country in one fell swoop. He's obviously was made famous a couple years ago for writing a $100 million check to the city of Newark for their school system. There are obviously critiques to be made of Facebook generally, and lots of people are making them. They have no women on their board. They still take advantage of corporate tax loopholes that are costing the Treasury billions. But in contrast to his co-founder, I think we're seeing someone who's not protesting that he actually owes his country something for the start it gave him.
Again, I'm speaking with Elise Hoag, who was a senior advisor to Media Matters for America, director of political advocacy and communications for MoveOn.org, and program director at the Rainforest Action Network, and the recipient of the Business Ethics Award of 2005. And, of course, this is really, I imagine people have said this to you before, that business ethics nowadays looks like an oxymoron.
It can sometimes, although, you know, I have to say that we are seeing a much more robust debate than we were 10 years ago about what it means to be ethical in the context of the encroaching corporate power. And, you know, I intentionally use the word one percenter rather than 1% because we do see, you know, there was a wonderful subset of the Occupy movement that was a 1% for the 99%. So values are values. Wealth in and of itself is not a bad thing. The question is how you use that wealth to make sure that the entire society benefits, because, of course, you know, a healthy society benefits everyone.
Well, we've had the J.P. Morgan Chase chairman, Jamie Dimon, whose company just lost $2 to $3 billion. He had been a very aggressive critic of regulation and had been quite dismissive of Paul Volcker and the so-called Volcker rule. Dismissive is putting it politely.
Mildly.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't think anyone is actually going to hold up too many of the banks as the paragon of virtue when it comes to new evolving models of corporate behavior. And in fact, I'm not sure that what we're going to see is any one corporation emerging as the sort of leader on social responsibility. We are seeing corporations start to play a little bit with what it means to, A, face backlash if they get out of line with their customers' values, right? We saw that with Apple and the iPhone when all the stories emerged about their business practices overseas and the conditions under which their workers operate. And then we saw Google experimenting with what it means to actually fight for open internet with the SOPA PIPA fight. So I think that we're just starting to see the potential power of the pocketbook and how we govern the corporations and what we expect of them. Now more than ever, people understand that their consumer choices are a reflection of their own values. And so we're going to, see corporations having to sort of evolve to respond to that or be the dinosaurs that we're seeing in the oil industry and the banking industry. And I don't think they have a long-term future unless they get their act together.
Well, two of the most egregious dinosaurs in the oil sector are the Koch brothers, who have aggressively invested in politics and in right-wing politics and in the Tea Party, and they're playing a very active role in this election. And I don't understand why there hasn't been a consumer boycott against Dixie cups and brawny paper towels and the many consumer products that they produce.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and it's one that, the groups that are engaged in trying to affect change at the level of the Koch brothers really need to explore. What we have seen, though, that does get at the Koch brothers' influence is an enormous amount of consumer pressure for companies to leave the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is heavily Koch brothers-backed, and as your listeners may or may not know, has been really the sort of feeding ground for right-wing legislation, including the, quote, stand your ground, what we like to call kill at will bill, that ended up, getting George Zimmerman potentially off the hook for shooting Trayvon Martin. So Coke, Pepsi, I think we're up to a dozen corporations that have left the ALEC structure, which is heavily Koch brothers backed, and one of the ways that they have tried to move legislation through the state level.
Well, it's interesting, the idea that these bilious billionaires, if you will, are so enabled by the Citizens United decision. I mean, the very nature of the 1% versus the 99% has had to be revised. And one of the latest numbers I heard was, in fact, the people who are buying this 2012 election, who basically are dominating the money race, are these super PACs. And in effect, our political future in this key election year is being decided by the 0.00063%.
Yeah, I'm not ready to actually cede this election year. I really do think that one of the benefits of Citizens United is that it's been a tipping point for many Americans to wake up to the corporate control of our democracy. And we're seeing an awareness and a pushback that is largely unprecedented about the money and politics issue. So I'm hopeful. In fact, I wrote a piece for The Nation a few months ago called Will Citizens United Actually Unite the Citizens? Because we know that the only thing that can really combat money and politics is citizens organizing together. And I think that the wake-up call of all of these anonymous third-party ads and its impact on our communities has really mobilized people in a way that we haven't really seen. So it may take a couple of cycles to really see the impact of that organizing, but at the end of the day, we do know that people power can actually combat money.
Well, I had a couple of campaign strategists, who, one of whom had run John McCain's presidential campaign and another run a number of Democratic presidential campaigns at a forum out here at UCLA that I host. And they basically said that what happens in our election years is that billions of dollars are raised from the special interests by candidates who effectively sell their soul. And then this money is turned over to the networks, or the main network monopolies, for ad buys. And that all of these buys basically go to the swing states in an election, which is only about a quarter of the electorate. And then later in the year, as we get towards October, all this money is funneled in to about between 3-6% of people are being targeted. And these are the people in October who still haven't made up their minds. And then by October, if you haven't made up your mind, you tend to be in a demographic that suggests that you're a mindless couch potato who never reads newspapers and what follows what's happening in the news. And the idea that our electoral fate is in the hands of morons is really quite disturbing. But they provided the statistical information.
You know, I will take issue with my colleagues on the other side of the aisle who put forward that. Not the basics. The basics is absolutely correct, that the money gets funneled to the networks and the network buys are disproportionately in the swing states. That's all absolutely true. I think that one of the things that political consultants don't give people credit for is the fact that they actually tune into issues that matter to them in their daily lives. And so there's a couple of different things at play when you're trying to speak to people through whatever mechanism. And one is actually persuasion, and there's this sort of holy grail of the swing voter that happens every single cycle and who can win them. And, you know, I think that sometimes they're more informed than others, but often they're really just paying attention to who they think is going to help them more, especially in the times of the slipping economy, which we're seeing now. There's also getting your own people out to vote and communicating in such a way that makes people feel as though their participation in democracy matters. And that's the part that concerns me the most about Citizens United, is that if we actually convince people that if they don't have $1 million to spend, that their participation in our democracy doesn't matter, there's a lot more at stake than who wins the next election. But on the point of the television, one of the things that's going to be really interesting as we head towards 2016, 2018, 2020, is that it's really an age demographic that is dependent on broadcast television for how they get their information. And that's disproportionately where all of these ad dollars go. And so what we're going to see is that it's going to be much more important to get very sophisticated on social media, very sophisticated in terms of micro-targeted ad buys on cable or on the web, in order to reach the sort of growing up class of voters who really don't watch television straight through with the ads and everything that our parents and grandparents did. So we're going to see the entire landscape of how we communicate to voters change in the next 4 to 8 years.
Well, Elise Hogue, we're having a somewhat different conversation from the Facebook IPO, but I'm fascinated by what you're telling us. But that's not to say that negative advertising doesn't work. I mean, it's been proven, I think, time and time again, that it, despite the despicable nature of it and how much it's dominating the airwaves, negative advertising tends to work. It certainly worked for Romney in bringing down Newt Gingrich. And my understanding is that in spite of the $1 billion that President Obama is supposed to be having to raise, he's going to be outspent in this election, probably by a substantial amount of money. So with a failing economy or a limping economy and the possibility of a euro crash that could impact it negatively, this could be a very good year for Mitt Romney. Do you think he can buy the election?
I think it remains to be seen. I think one of the things that you said I totally agree with, which is that the forces on the other side, because they know that they can get the Republican candidates to do their bidding, they have infinite pockets and they're willing to spend what it takes. The question, and I should say, I'm not in the business of predicting elections this far out. I've seen too many things change in the course of the last 6 months. I think it's very hard to predict. But I think the challenge for the Democrats and progressives who care about reelecting President Obama or just trying to get their local representative elected to the state senate, because a lot of legislation is moving at the state that actually is impacting our lives even greater than the gridlock we're experiencing federally, right, is that we've got to challenge ourselves, be innovative, and think about one of the things that we know that is more effective than negative advertising is peer-to-peer communication. Is that I go out and talk to as many people I know who trust my impression, and then they go out and talk to as many people as they know. It's basic old organizing, but we've got new tools to do it. And I think it's going to be a challenge to see if we can utilize those tools in a way that combats the big money, because I think there's no doubt, you're correct, that you know the deep pockets will definitely be able to outspend Obama and all of the other candidates on the Democratic side.
Well, just in closing, Elise Hogue, you certainly hit the nail on the head there in terms of what's gone on at the state level. And the Koch brothers, of course, and Alec have been very much involved in the blizzard of legislation that's changed the nature of a lot of the state governments. It's almost as if we've gone back to the period before, was it the 13th Amendment that led to the direct elections of senators, because previously to that they were appointed by state legislatures, which were in turn controlled by the big railroad barons and other corporations. And it sounds as if we're sort of going back to that era where the state legislatures are controlled by big money, and they've proven that. And I don't see any countervailing equivalent on the political left to how well organized the right has been and how much they've got the jump on everybody.
Well, I mean, it's going to be an interesting thing, and that's why it's so important for everybody to watch what happens in Wisconsin. The conventional wisdom was that Governor Walker was absolutely untouchable because he was backed by so many big donors, and yet you've got over a million people that in the course of several months signed a recall petition, and now the guy's political future is actually in question. There's still a lot of work to do, and there's 3 weeks before the election. But one of the things that we've learned, not only with the ALEC measures, but with all of the state measures that are really oppressing immigrants right now and actually rolling back decades of women's rights and reproductive choice, is that this is a national playing field, and some of it happens at the state level. So state fights are fights for everyone because they move the goalposts and they change the national debate about issues that impact all of us. The good news about the state fights is that it goes back to the peer-to-peer organizing, and when you're on a smaller playing field, you can actually touch more people. So, you know, I hope your listeners will not only pay attention to what's going on in Wisconsin, but everywhere around the country, because it's what could happen in your state if you don't think about organizing in terms of your own political priorities and your own values.
Well, I thank you, Elise Hogue. I must just say in closing that piece of video that came out of Wisconsin showing a woman who's a local billionaire, basically telling Scott Walker what she wants him to do, which is to turn Wisconsin into a right-to-work state. And he's quite supine and quite obedient. If ever there was the face of the 1%, I know that's not what the focus in the media was, but to my mind, that woman really was the face of the 1% in terms of buying our politics.
I absolutely agree, and that is the face of one potential future, but I have seen too many fights being won with just good old-fashioned organizing to be too pessimistic. So I would like to leave your listeners with the idea that if we actually all get engaged and all actually passionately pursue the kind of democracy we want to see, we really can make a difference.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Elise Hogue, who's a social change practitioner, media consumer and analyst, and online engagement expert. Previously, she served as senior advisor to Media Matters for America, director of political advocacy and communications for MoveOn.org, and program director at the Rainforest Action Network. She was the recipient of the Business Ethics Network Award in 2005 for her work in the financial sector and has been a frequent speaker and writer about corporate power, corporate accountability, and multinational institutions that govern financial and corporate behavior. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the anniversary of the indignants, those that feel indignation against what's happening in Spain.
Can't buy me love.
that makes you feel all right. I'll get you anything, my friend, if it makes you feel all right. 'Cause I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love. I'll give you all I've got to give.